Hello, I'm Francis Seeley from GlobalNet 21. This podcast is the second that we've done with Cormac Russell of Nurture Development. Cormac has already done one webinar with us, and we turned that into a podcast. This is based on a second webinar, and we've turned this into a podcast as well. Here he talks about the art of community building. Cormac is one of the leading experts in asset-based community development, and in this webinar, he talks about how community building is intuitive and based upon art, and he looks at some of the basic building blocks of community building.
I wanted to start by sharing very quickly two stories. The first story is a story very quickly around an experience I had in the flight. And I sat beside a wonderful gentleman from Greece, and we talked a long, long, long way into the evening about the experience that folks in Greece have had recently in relation to the economic retrenchment and so on and so forth there. And then he also shared and regaled some wonderful stories about the philosophical origins of his family. And he reminded me of a quote, which I think seems apt to the subject matter that we're talking about tonight, which is building community from inside out. And we're looking at the art and the craft of building community from inside out. And the quote, it's a proverb, actually. It's a Greek proverb, which says that a civilization flourishes when people plant trees under whose shade they will never sit. I love that quote because it reminds us of the importance of investing not just in our own self-interest, but in the interests of future generations, and thinking beyond self-interest to something that's higher and bigger and more significant than us as individuals seems to be at the heart of why we would want to do community building well. So that was the first story, and it's just it shortened the flight considerably for me, sitting beside somebody with such a depth of wisdom and humor. The second story is a story about what I would say is at the heart of asset-based community development is a story about the 18th camel. And this is going to exercise your brains a little bit and mine too, because there's a little bit of maths in this, but I think it's a lovely allegory of why asset-based thinking is so powerful when it comes to building community. So as the story goes, there was a stranger traveling on a camel through a desert. And after several days of traveling, he came to the edge of an oasis. And sitting at the edge of the oasis, he saw three brothers weeping, crying unconsolably. So he dismounted his camel, and in a sympathetic gesture, he went and asked what was wrong. And the eldest brother spoke on behalf of the others, and he said, "We're weeping because our father passed away 3 days ago." And so the stranger commiserated with the three brothers. And the eldest brother said, "Well, we're crying not just in grief, but also in frustration. Because just before our father passed away, he left us with a challenge which we can't fulfill. And in our culture, the inability of a son to fulfill his father's dying wish is a point of great shame." So the stranger was curious and intrigued and asked, "Well, what was the challenge that your father set?" And the eldest brother spoke again on behalf of the three brothers, and he said, "Well, our father's dying wish was that we would divide his worldly possessions, whereby I, as the eldest son, would receive one half of his worldly possessions. My second eldest brother would receive a third, and our youngest brother would receive a ninth. But the problem is, when our father passed, he left only 17 camels to his name, and you simply can't do the maths on that." So the stranger, in an effort to be helpful, offered the brothers his camel. He said, "If you take my camel, you'll be able to fulfill your father's wish." But the brothers had been raised in a culture where they had been thought to be suspicious of strangers bearing gifts, and so they rejected his offer out of hand. But the stranger was a wise and patient peacemaker, And so he convinced the brothers that if they accepted his gift, they wouldn't be diminished, nor indeed would he be diminished. And so accordingly, they did. Now they had 18 camels. And so they went about dividing their father's worldly possessions plus one. And so they took from 18 half of the camels, which was 9, which went to the eldest brother. And then they took a third of 18 camels to the second eldest brother, which was 6. And finally, they gave a 9th to the youngest brother. And if you add that up, what you get is 17. And in a sense, that's a wonderful allegory for what we're talking about when it comes to ABCD. Because ABCD isn't about bringing something from outside in to communities, but it's about helping communities look at what they've already got and figuring out how they can use what they have in a way that's more effective. So in a sense, for this particular webinar, what I'd like us to consider is, what is the 18th camel? And my proposal is that the 18th camel is, in fact, community building. We live in a culture where, as I said in the last webinar, the 18th camel for most people is the marketplace. The assumption is that more services equal a better life. And I think what we're seeing all over the world now is a shift from that consumerist narrative to a narrative that says, well, in fact, maybe our good life is in using what we have more effectively. So as we look at how that shift comes about, one of the things that I think we're realizing, and we talked about this in detail in the last webinar, but just to link this webinar with the last webinar, is we're beginning to see that this fundamentally is about power. And power has grown when citizens are at the center of democracy, not those in paid or in political positions. So seeing the shift whereby the old way of doing things was where donors, partners, and government led the way. They set the criteria. We applied to them through various funding streams, and we got professionals to come in and do our community building for us. We're beginning to see more and more evidence of communities being facilitated to drive their own change. It's not to suggest that outside contributions aren't important. Of course they are. But this is about sequence. And so a lot of what I'm going to talk about really is how we're beginning to think about this new sequence, this new balance in the first instance, a balance between service provision on one hand and community building on another, where the cultural dominance in the West is service provision. And that's not just a dominant perspective in the world of professionalism, it's a dominant perspective in an awful lot of communities. So a lot of neighborhoods, particularly where neighborhoods are considered to be low-income neighborhoods, are working on the assumption that the only way things will get better is if somebody from outside comes in to make them better. What's really intriguing for me in asset-based community development, we go back to the 18th camel again, is that the outsider is largely a facilitator, not a service provider, not a solution provider, but what they bring to the party is the art of questioning, the art of building a framework within which people can use what they have first and then secure what they need from outside to match what they have. In the UK, we have been spending a lot of time really reflecting on how that plays out in practice in an actual neighborhood. And in Thurrock and Leeds and Kirklees and Gloucestershire and Torbay and Croydon, we have been spending time thinking about the question of the 18th camel with neighborhoods, with local people, and with professionals, and really thinking about working in a very, very different way, working in a way that's much more akin to facilitating communities to use what they have, than working on the assumption that communities are places where they're the sum of their problems and they're deficient, and our job as professionals is to come in and stuff the deficiency. One of the things that I've learned from working in the learning sites across the UK, and I've done this in a number of different countries across the world, is that I think for a long, long time, what outside agencies have tended to do is to try to bring services and resources into neighborhoods And in a sense, if you want to think about this in metaphorical terms, it's almost like trying to drive a 3-ton truck into a neighborhood over a bridge with only 1-ton capacity. In a sense, community building is about building that bridge, that capacity, but starting within the context of the community and supporting them then to define what resources they want that truck to hold when it does arrive in town. And I suppose, in a sense, what that means in practice is working in a way that very much leads by stepping back, that starts to decolonize neighborhoods and starts to deprofessionalize neighborhoods and starts to ask a whole set of very different questions. Questions that are premised on, what are your dreams for your neighborhood? And how can you use what's already in your neighborhood to realize your dreams? Once you've done that, what else do you need from outside that you don't have within this place? Now, the proposition is if we do that, what we will actually discover quite naturally is a way of raising our children in a much more effective, much more connected way, a way of aging well in place, a way of stewarding our ecology, a way of dealing with economic and environmental crisis when they come, a way of growing resiliency, and a way of building a more sustainable, just economic and health base, not just for individuals, but for everybody across the life course. And it's really interesting because when we go into neighborhoods, effectively what we're doing is we're going in on an invitation by a number of local people who've decided instead of organizing their neighborhood on a mission by mission basis or a project by project basis, in other words, instead of focusing on single issues or on, you know, primary issues that, you know, matter to a particular group, we're being invited into neighborhoods by people that I call community weavers, people at local level who get that the power of building community is not in individual initiatives or projects, but in the capacity to weave all of the individual passions, projects, and concerns together in some kind of way. So in a way, it's the association of associations that creates power. So what's interesting in the heritage of ABCD, I suppose, is that what we're largely doing is we're trying to figure out what are the building blocks in this place, in this neighborhood, and how can they be connected by the people in the neighborhood in a way that creates enduring change that the people themselves have defined and are creating. And what we've found everywhere we've gone over the last 30, 40 years, because there's 50 members of the ABCD Institute faculty around the world, so there's a lot of learning across the globe in this. People like me and people like some of the people who've committed their time to be here with us tonight, who've just been in neighborhoods trying to understand what it means to be an outsider and a facilitator that's useful and doesn't overwhelm local capacity. And I think what we've learned is that there are 6 building blocks to building a community from inside out. The first building block is people, like the people you see in the slide here. People who are defining themselves more by what it is that they can contribute to community and to life in general than what they receive, right? So people who are defining themselves as citizens, not as clients. People who actually see that their role in life is to use the gifts that they have and find a way of having them in some way get connected with the gifts of other people. And there are a critical mass of people we know that exist in every single neighborhood who do that. So that's the first building block. And it's a primary building block because it's people, not programs, not power, not privilege, and not position, but people who fundamentally make differences in organizations, in communities, and in civilizations. The second building block is associational life. And what I mean by associational life is the informal social networks. The more informal they are, the more curious I am about them. Because informal social networks are where freedom and care is produced. We see now all over the world, people use the word care and prefixing the, you know, different things like Medicare in the States. Medicare does not care. Medicare is a big, monolithic, bureaucratic system that doesn't know we exist. We are numbers. Care is the freely given gift of the heart, one person to another. And it's produced in associational life where people are not paid to do it. They're not mandated to do it. They're not bullied to do it. They're not controlled to do it. They do it consensually. Because care absolutely is an intrinsic act of consent. So if we're looking for the locus of care in society, in any society, and the place to look for it is in associational life. And that's why I'm interested in the informal social networks. Because often the more formal networks, the more constituted networks, the more grant-dependent networks are less free than the more informal ones. So that's the second building block. And everywhere we go where we see health increasing from inside out, we see prosperity increasing from inside out, we see sustainable, ecological, environmental, and energy-based production coming from inside out, what we're witnessing is a critical density of associational life, people coming together, taking their individual gifts and using the capacity to connect with other people to create a vehicle to amplify and multiply those gifts. And that has a name in sociology, and its name is association. So that's where you take the individual gifts and you multiply the power. Because we're talking about power here. Many of the issues that we're talking about are political issues. Health is a political issue, right? It's about power. It's about control. It's not about clinical intervention. We know this. Health is a condition that we produce. And there are all sorts of structural reasons why it can be easy or hard to do that. So how do we build an association that allows us to channel our healthful and health-producing behavior and multiply and amplify it? We do that by forming relationships with other people and building those relationships up. Now, if you want to build even more power, then the way to do that is to build an association of associations. In a lot of countries where I work, I hear the term partnership being used, and I often think that partnership is code in a lot of the countries where I have been for what I would think is probably the mutual suppression of loathing in pursuit of government funding. It's not really partnership at all. But where an association of association forms around a common vision, then you might see a situation where people plant trees under whose shade they will never sit, because the vision drives them beyond their own particular project, their own particular area of self-interest, their own particular area of personal interest, to something that's actually more about a community interest, a vision that goes 10 years, 20 years out. The other building blocks are critical to realizing the fullness or the flourishing nature of community. And those building blocks on top of individual contribution and associational life are the ecology of the place, the actual physicality of the place, the economic, and not just economic, but energy and social capital exchange of the place, the stories and the culture of the place, and the institutions of the place that have learned how to act like treasure chests instead of fortress walls. So everywhere we go, these are the six building blocks that we encounter. And what we're seeing is effectively those ingredients in various recipes being connected and brought together to generate the possibility of an enduring future for the people who live there, what I would call a culture of community. So the connections are absolutely the critical piece. I often think that asset-based community development is misnamed because it suggests that the critical focus is on the assets. Well, in fact, the assets are simply a means to an end. The end is connection. The reason that assets are a useful focus is because if you want to build reciprocity, if you want to build an association of associations that's truly powerful, right, that actually can create an enduring change that's driven by citizens, not driven by paid professionals who speak for us, but driven by us as local people in our place with our culture and our vision, then we need to create a culture of community. And it's that culture of community that fundamentally allows us to do things beyond our own self-interest. But how do you get there? How do you actually go from what often is a place like my neighborhood, where so few people actually know each other, where people are living in many respects as estranged citizens, where we are in maybe head nodding acquaintance with the people that we share the street with, but we really don't know their gifts, we really don't know their passions, and we're a long way off from sharing a vision that we've co-created. Well, that's part, I think, fundamentally of the art of community building and what I want to turn my attention to in the last few minutes that I have. I believe that getting from where we are now, which is often a neighborhood of strangers, to a culture of community or an association of associations with a vision beyond itself, is about starting with where people are at. Instead of judging them, I think community building accepts the world as it should be, or as it is, not as it should be. So community building accepts the world as it is, not as it should be, so that they can work with people to co-create a world as it should be, not as it is. And so the world is as it is. It is fundamentally a very disconnected place, but it's also a place full of assets. So where we start in neighborhoods and some of the learning sites that I'd mentioned earlier on is by actually just talking with people, discovering what it is people care about. But we know we can't do that on our own. So the very first thing that a community builder would do in a neighborhood is find people that we call connectors. And connectors are local, unpaid citizens who are just really good at building relationships. That's their passion. Some people are really good at setting agendas for other people to follow. And some people are really good at finding out what people care about themselves and supporting and activating them to do the thing they care about. They're also fantastic at saying, well, I know other people who share the kinds of concerns you do, and we're going to meet next Thursday night for coffee. Would you come along? So in Croydon and in Gloucestershire and in Kirklees and other places we're working, the first thing that we do is we find these connectors who tend not to be leaders, who tend not to be the people standing with the microphone at the front of the room. And if they are at meetings, they don't tend to like meetings. They kind of work on the basis of why have a meeting when you can have a party. But if they are at meetings, they're in the middle of the room handing out cake and making connections. Now, it would be important to say they're not networkers. Networkers are what we see in business terms, people who are looking for opportunities and connecting those opportunities together. There's nothing wrong with that. They're entrepreneurial. But connectors tend to just get a buzz out of seeing people connect and mobilize into action. And so that's our first stepping point, finding connectors. And in different places we work, what we try to do is find as many as represent the diversity of the neighborhood. We try to work in neighborhoods of no more than about 3,000 people. And we try to work in places that, you know, are recognizable to people as communities, as neighborhoods. So we don't work in wards per se, because nobody recognizes a ward as a community. But we try to work in places where people say, this is my home. Outside of my door and around that place, that's what I call my neighborhood, or that's what I call my community. That's the scale we work to. So this is hyper-local street-level working. And so finding the connectors, the local people who know between 50 to 80 people in their local neighborhood by first name, is our first step. And our second step is to support them to have learning conversations. And what I mean by learning conversations is they literally talk to their neighbors. And we say to them, don't talk to anybody you don't know. Talk to the people you do know. The power, the social innovation in community building is not that we go and we talk to people we don't know straight off, but we start with where people are at and then we build out from there. And so in many respects, what we're talking about really is we're talking about trying to begin to discover what people care about enough to act upon. But doing that not for an outsider's purposes, but for the purposes of weaving the community together. So there's no point in an outside community builder going in and door knocking, right? Because then it's the outsider that's building the relationships with the citizens. That's not the game changer. The game changer is when we can use our facilitation skills to support the community to form new relationships with itself and each other. And that's the difference between community organizing and community building. And yes, Barack Obama was trained by John McKnight, who created or co-created the framework of ABCD in 1986. That's where he learned to be president, and where some would argue he forgot in his second term of office most of what he learned. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting is there are overlaps between organizing and community building. There are differences as well. That's one of the critical differences. So what we're trying to do really is we're trying to support people to have new conversations. Why? Because if you want to change reality and you want to change culture, change the conversation. And so the community connectors are changing culture by changing conversation with each other. It's neighbor to neighbor. Typically, we would say to people, have five conversations a week with your neighbors. And at the end of each conversation, ask each neighbor who they know that you don't know, and ask them, will they come with you to have a conversation with that new person? And so we kind of snowball out into what I would say are the extended reaches of the neighborhood, to the places at the edge where many people are not included. And that's it. It's as simple as that. It's about having conversations, but not just with individuals, also with people who are in association already. So the connectors, as well as talking to their neighbors, would also speak with associations. And literally, you know, some people use the term asset mapping. Well, what I've just described to you is asset mapping. Talking to individuals and talking to clubs and groups and saying, what do you care about enough to act upon? Not what's your opinion about what others should do, but what's your intrinsic motivation to get up off your couch and do something, whether you're an individual citizen or you're a community group. And that's a reading club, to a poker club, to a formal group. What is it you care about enough to act upon? Beyond the mission, beyond what it says on the door, well, when I walk through here, it says you're a football club. I get that. And I get, you know, you train kids in football and whatnot, and you compete. But what else drives you? What's your passion? What keeps you awake at night? If you could set up a business that would change the local community, what would you love to do? When you forget time, what is it you're doing that makes you forget time? When was the last time in your life that you gave to somebody with no expectation of return who wasn't a friend or a member of your family? Those kinds of questions. And they're powerful, revealing questions. But as well as asking people what they care about enough to act upon, right? These neighbors, these connectors, are also asking people, what skills, gifts, capacities, talents they have that they can use within them and around them in service of the thing that they dream about. So we're saying to people, think about what you're dreaming about, not just, you know, personally, but for your community. What would you love to see happen in this neighborhood? If three or four of your neighbors would help you, what would you love to do on your street? Those kinds of questions. And those kinds of questions do something very powerful to somebody. Something that's very different than the kinds of questions that you get asked at consultation meetings, right? When outside agencies come in with agendas like health or well-being, or even more, you know, sexy terms these days like resilience, right? This is a very, very different way of beginning to understand what it is that drives community. And it's interesting because, you know, I'm reflecting a lot now about the art of community building. And I do think it's an art or a craft. And it strikes me that the actual act of going as a community builder and finding and supporting community connectors is really, really nuanced. And its biggest challenge is the challenge of actually leading by stepping back, of not doing unto or doing for, but finding a way of really supporting the neighborhood itself to renegotiate and form new connections. So my sense is that what we're describing when we talk about the six stepping stones or some of the methodology that I'm describing now, like finding connectors, talking with associations, beginning to do asset mapping, the kinds of questions that I'm sharing with you. In a sense, what they are is They are the palette of paints, and they are the canvas. Right? The neighborhood is the canvas, I guess. The palette of paints are the assets, the building blocks, and some of the techniques that I'm describing. But the art is in the capacity of the community builder to do something interesting, bespoke, and local in that in that environment. That's truly created by neighbors. So in Hodge Hill, my good friend Al Barrett in Hodge Hill in Birmingham, the way he thought about it was, because he's a pastor there, right? So he said to his community, well, what would happen if we asked the wider community to tell us who they think the connectors are? But he didn't use the word connector because nobody knows what connector means in broad terms. He said, you know, who are the unsung heroes who stitch this community together, who keep it glued together? Who are they? And he got people to nominate, you know, to say, these are the people who are holding our community together. They're not standing with megaphones in their hands, but in different quiet ways, they keep this community alive and together. And he invited those people and the people who nominated them to come and have a celebration. And then he asked them to talk about what it were. And then he asked them what they have in the neighborhood that they could use to realize those dreams. And then he supported them to begin to use those dreams. Now, that's asset-based community development. They're connecting on the basis of an intrinsic motivation to act using their strengths. And theoretically, we believe, and practically, we know that this is a much more enduring way to mobilize change. You see, if all you're doing is organizing people to fight an external enemy, well, victory then becomes defeat. Because when you win, effectively, you've got to find another enemy or another problem. So either you become addicted to conflict and confrontation, which is possible, but I don't think as a theory of change, it's a very enduring theory of change. So that's a challenge. And it's a useful thing to enter into conflict sometimes and to challenge external enemies. We need to do that. But I suppose it's like any tool, it's limited. So if you want to chop down a tree, you wouldn't use a hammer. And I suppose community building is a tool to try and create change based on a theory that says that people are mobilized much more by using the strengths, capacities, and assets within and around them to make change happen over a 10, 20, 30, 40-year period. That's why I started with the Greek proverb. But ultimately, when those common themes start to emerge, you can start to find ways of connecting people to those themes, to the things that they care about enough to act upon collectively. And what we tend to do then is invite the community across those themes into what we call an ideas fair or a community conversation and support them to take action. There's lots of different ways that people take action. Sometimes it's just about sitting down and talking through what it is they see as the issue and how they themselves want to take that issue forward, what assets they want to use to do it. Sometimes it requires some external resource. And what we tend to do is make sure that we work with the community to ensure that they're using the resource in a way that doesn't diminish them. So what I mean by that, for example, is if you look at some of the matching funds initiatives that I know some of you know about in our work, or what we call small sparks, what we're intentionally doing there is we're ensuring that money doesn't lead, but that people's passions lead first. They're the primary investment. And the secondary investment, the match, is money. So if you look at the model like in Seattle, Jim Deere's work, what you actually begin to see is what he did over 20 years was figure out a way that Seattle local government could be of service to the community using money. So they used very, very small amounts of money and said to people, for every hour of sweat equity you put into doing what you care about, your priority, we will recognize that. It's a different kind of capital, but it is a valuable capital. It's social capital. And we'll recognize that in our worldview, which is fiscal. So we'll recognize every hour of sweat equity as being valuable. And we'll recognize that as having a value of $10 an hour. So from now on, you're not receiving our charity, you're receiving a match. You just use different collateral. And in a way, what he was trying to do there was he was trying to say that social capital matters more than City Hall's fiscal capital. And he was trying to renegotiate the power relationships. And I think it was a really, really smart thing for him to do as a city official. Not surprisingly, he was trained as a community builder. But the thing that I think is interesting about that experience, and we're seeing this play out in the UK as well, is over 20 years in Seattle, they've invested $50 million this way. And in return, $77 million worth of social capital has been contributed in the community. And more importantly, hundreds of thousands of people who would have previously, in the old way of engaging community, never have gotten involved, are now newly involved. And that's, I think, hugely powerful and illustrates in empirical terms the potential that exists in our neighborhoods. There is no substitute, there is no surrogate for neighborhood power when it comes to caring for the environment, raising our children, aging well in place, creating economic prosperity, and doing something serious about social justice. There just is no replacement in the systems or institutional world. And we have mountains of evidence of that effect. So when people come to these ideas fairs and they begin to take their ideas, their dreams into action, what we begin to see is people journeying from being clients of services to being citizens, co-creating a shared vision of their future. That kind of flexing of civic muscle means that when we eventually get to a conversation about what's your vision for the next 10 or 20 years for this neighborhood, we are talking to a room full of citizens who have flexed civic muscle, who have stories to tell about how they've used what they have and they've put it together in a way that's productive. How they've actually used their civic power to create a future for themselves and their children. And so when we say, well, okay, let's dream ourselves into a 10, 20-year scenario. What kind of neighborhood do you want? What are the 100 things that absolutely need to happen for this to be a great neighborhood? And when people identify those things, they talk about really high-level, sophisticated things. They talk about how they would dream that people over the age of 65 who aren't sick enough to be in hospital but currently are in hospitals because they can't come home because the community isn't hospitable enough to actually care for them and their family is too far away. People would say, we dream of a community where people can come home. And instead of having to settle for a hospital bed, they can get what they really need, which is a hospitable community. We dream of a community where people at the edge actually can give the gifts right at the center on their terms. We dream of a community where if we do all of this hard work and we create a fantastic place to live, that we don't actually gentrify our community so that when our kids are old enough and they want to live here, they can't afford to buy a house here. And they talk about those things. So when those 100 things are identified and we ask the three, I think, fundamental questions of the social contract, which are of those 100 things, which of these can you do using people power from inside out? Which of these things, the second question, which of these things can you do yourselves, but with some help from outside agencies? And the third question, what is it that only outside agencies can do on this list of 100 things? And here's the rub, and I'll finish on this. The vast majority of things that people say they want to have a good life in their neighborhood and to have a great place to live are within the power of people themselves. The second largest determinants of a great place to live are through co-production. The thing that least determines a great place to live in terms of economic, environmental, health, social care and community safety are the contributions of agencies. Now, we've known this for years. Epidemiologists have told us for years the five things that determine how long we live and how quickly we recover when we're unwell are our own personal agency, our associational life, our environmental conditions, our economic circumstances. And the least significant thing in terms of determining how well we are is pharmacological intervention and clinical intervention. And yet we live in a world that suggests the opposite is true. So the art of community building is not just about building neighborhoods. It's about building democracy. It's about putting the power back in the hands of people. Because in the final analysis, we are the people we've been waiting for if we can become the change we seek. And the way to do that is to focus on community building and not just on service delivery. So my vision would be that we have a community builder who can do what I described in every neighborhood. And you know something? We have the resources to do it. So it's a question of whether we have the will to actually use the resources in a way that doesn't serve professionals' interests, but actually serves the interests of citizens, which, as I understand it, is the call of democracy.